The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. I hope everybody is having a fabulous day today. We're going to start with our first article in the wellness section. The thing a teacher said that changed my life. 12 indelible lessons that made an even bigger difference outside the classroom. Often the most important thing we learn from a teacher isn't academic at all. Sometimes it's a kind of observation, a simple show of faith, or maybe a sly permission. Other times it's a question that cuts right to the core, and once in a while, it's just plain calling us on our stuff. Now that the school year is in full swing, we asked women across the country, plus a cohort of Oprah Daily insiders and editors, for the lines that pulled them through or jolted them awake, both back in the day and ever since. Number one, fate is like a carousel. If you miss your horse the first time, or the second, third, fourth, or fifth time, it will come around for you again. I was studying writing, and I thought if I wasn't successful right away, I would never be. Holding on to the image of a carousel helped me keep writing and writing, kept me grabbing for my horse. It wound up taking me 15 years to publish my first book. Now I'm working on my third. Aletha Black, 54, Los Angeles. Number two, you have to be brave. An art teacher told me that. She meant it about the creative process, but it became kind of a mantra to me while I was going through a difficult divorce. Getting through that, the very creative process of reinventing myself, was the bravest thing I've ever had to do. Allie O'Neill, 49, Fairfield, Connecticut. Number three, you don't choose a life path knowing where it will lead. You choose to keep taking steps that feel right and trust that simply by moving forward, you are heading to where you need to go. I was overcome with decision paralysis when I graduated college. Up until that point, the metrics and path to success felt absurdly straightforward. I was literally given a piece of paper at the start of each term outlining what was expected of me week by week. And if I did what was on that paper, I would be given a numerical score confirming my achievement, as well as abundant praise. For the first time in my life, I had to decide for myself what success meant and how to achieve it. I was terrified. My professor helped me see that I wasn't deciding in that instant what I wanted my entire life to look like. I was just deciding to make the next best steps with the information I had at the time. Eventually, those steps would form their own path. Charlie Burlock, 26, Oprah Daily Contributing Associated Books Editor. Number four, what are you doing? I grew up in a small, very poor town in northern Nevada. My family was okay until I became a teenager. Then I fell in with a bad crowd and stopped going to classes. At the same time, things got really rough with my parents. A month after I turned 16, I dropped out and ran away from home. I wound up living on the streets in Reno. When I was 17, I heard about a program that helped you get job skills. I walked there. They said the most important thing I needed to do was get a high school equivalency diploma. While I worked at a daycare center, I'd always loved kids, and lived in a pay-by-week motel, I began to get my GED. It was a teacher at that night school, I wish I remembered his name, who asked me that question. I was so scared because I didn't have a clue what I was doing, and I thought I was in trouble. Instead, this teacher was trying to make me see that I was setting my sights for myself too low. He explained that because I'd tested out of almost all the classes I needed for the GED, I could begin taking classes at the community college. Right away, I thought he was crazy. I didn't think kids like me went to college. But someone believing in you is amazing motivation. I quickly earned 64 credits at the community college and transferred to a four-year college. I majored in both early childhood education and human development / family studies. I got my bachelor's degree, then my master's degree. Soon I got a job with the local school district running a program for teen moms. I loved my job, but I think because I'd had to work so hard to get myself a stable home, I was always interested in real estate too. During the COVID pandemic, a lot of realtor classes went online, so I got my license. I thought I'd do real estate as a side gig, even when I wound up making a lot more money selling houses than I did teaching. Teaching seemed more stable, and stable appeals to me. But when the school district cut my program last year, I asked myself that old question, "What are you doing?" I gave my notice to the school district and have been happily and profitably selling houses full-time ever since. Michelle Hammond, 41, Reno, Nevada. Number 5, run your own race. Ms. Werley, that's W-E-R-L-E-Y, was a PE teacher at my high school who also coached track. She meant, stay in your own lane, manage your own goals, and remember competitors will peak at different times. Remember that the race is long and that what is currently happening to your left and right is not a reflection of the end result. Stay in your own lane. Lee Barrows Filippini, 57, Philadelphia. Number 6. I know you'll get there. I was a wayward teen, behind in my schoolwork and skipping class, but my English teacher saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. She called my mom and, to my total dismay, arranged for me to go over to her house once a week to do my homework. At no time did she help me. She just sat with a gin and tonic tinkling in a glass as I studied. We didn't talk much on those long winter evenings, but I do remember her saying, "I know you'll get there." Years later, I did get there, with 2 English degrees and a career as a journalist. I often think back to her faith in me during that fraught time and realize what a difference it made. Rosie Hopegood, 37, Oprah Daily Deputy Health Editor. Number 7. Did your carriage break down? I had a first period government class my senior year of high school that I was always late for. Frankly, I thought making sure my hair was perfectly curled was far more important than anything I might learn about the separation of powers or whatever Mr. Neal was teaching. One day, when I swanned in, he asked me that question in front of the whole class, before I could even sit down. It wasn't long after Princess Diana married Prince Charles. I think the whole world had watched her arrive at the cathedral in a carriage. All of a sudden, I saw how royally selfish I was being to disrupt class every single day. I'd like to say I was never tardy again after that, but the truth is I remained extremely concerned about how my hair looked. However, I got some perspective and was on time to class most of the time from then on. And as I traveled into adulthood, I began to use that question as a kind of a personal maxim to motivate me to show respect to other people and to get to places on time. Most of the time. Amanda Robb, 57, New York City. Number 8. If you get to a boring part, skip it. My 5th grade teacher, Brenda Horvath, was vivacious, funny, and unorthodox. She showed us the movie Excalibur, rated R, when we were studying King Arthur and playing terrifying records portraying Aztec child sacrifices. She passed out chocolate-shaped soaps on April Fool's Day, and she always recommended books above our grade level, like To Kill a Mockingbird and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I'm sure she said this line to us in passing, to squash a complaint during reading time, but for a rule follower like me, it was freeing. Mrs. Horvath, with her groovy shag haircut and bright pink lipstick, gave me permission to break the rules and stretch past my comfort zone. Jenny Tung, 52, Oprah Daily Senior Director Wellness. Number 9. Start your stories local. You are an expert of your own neighborhood. Long before he wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning memoir, Angela's Ashes, Frank McCourt was my creative writing teacher at Stuyvesant High School. Many of us students thought out our own little worlds were boring, too boring to write about, and definitely too boring for anyone to want to read about. But Mr. McCourt taught us that everyone's story is unique and interesting, and if a story is told really well and very honestly, it will have universal resonance. He proved it by telling us his amazing stories, which were not about anything exotic, just things he was an expert in, what he had access to, which was poverty and teaching. It was an amazing lesson, not just in how to write well, but in how to connect with all our fellow human beings. In the years since then, I've published countless articles and essays, as well as 6 books. Though the stories I've told have taken me all the way to Antarctica, one way or another, most have started right in my own neighborhood, right where I grew up. Lori Gwen Shapiro, 57, New York City. Number 10, Practice Makes Permanent. I was on the softball team in high school. At first, I thought I should save my intensity for game day. But after Coach Bill Belt told me this, I started working my rear off in practice, too. My game days got a lot better, and the advice turned out to apply to a lot more than softball. As I grew up, I saw I could apply it to everything. It's about understanding that there's no use in doing anything halfway. If you're going to do anything, commit, and really give it everything you've got and do the absolute best you can. Dina Hunter Valentine, 52, Eugene, Oregon. Number 11, vary your sentence lengths. When my teacher first said this, I thought it was just writing style advice. But over the years, I've learned as parent, a boss, and yes, an editor, that if you allow yourself to get too long-winded for more than 1 or 2 sentences in a row, invariably your message will land as a lecture or screed. At best, people glaze over. Mind case scenario. They tune you out. And if you really blather on, you run the serious risk of provoking the exact opposite reaction than the one you wanted. When you apply the rigor of intermittent brevity, aka good pacing, there's a much better chance that people will genuinely hear you, pay attention to you, and maybe even come to share your point of view. Pilar Guzman, 53, Oprah Daily Editorial Director. Number 12, you matter and there's nothing wrong with you. I was abused as a child, badly, in a lot of ways. My safe space was with my grandparents, but when I was in the middle of 10th grade, my mom moved us away from them to the other side of town. I had to leave not only my extended family, but all my friends and my first puppy love, too. Also, I had to go from a school that had mostly black kids to one that was predominantly white. I'm black. At the new school, I was like a walking sore, very withdrawn, depressed, a loner. To be honest, I thought about suicide a lot. My history teacher at the new school was Miss Odessa Johnson. She was stern but kind. One day after class, she asked me about my life. Nothing too hard, just like what I did after school. Over time, I wound up telling her a lot of what I was going through. She became a soft place in the chaos of my life. That someone like her cared about me kept me going, got me through to graduation when I could start my own life. That she thought I was important and okay, not bad in any way. Well, it became something I could tell myself. It became something I could believe. Josette Penegar, 58, Fort Worth, Texas. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Moving over to Oprah's Insider, Oprah pays tribute to an inspiring professor. Hello, Insiders. I don't know if you all remember, but back in June we did a The Life You Want class with Dr. Ronald Griffiths. Those of you who did see that would remember that Dr. Griffiths was a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine who had dedicated his life to studying the human mind, and in particular, his body of work focused on the way altered brain states, brought on by meditation or even mind-altering drugs, could change the way we see the world and our own place in the world. Almost 2 years ago, Dr. Griffiths was diagnosed with late-stage colon cancer. It saddens me to say that he did pass away this past week. I know he wanted to make it to October. When I first called him, he said that the prognosis was, hopefully, October. I'm sending, of course, my thoughts to his family, his wife Marla, and his children, Sylvie, Jenny, and Morgan. He leaves behind a legacy of such great work, but he also leaves behind a blueprint of the grace and dignity we can only hope to face in our own final days. And I just wanted to say that when we spoke, what moved me most was the way he approached his death. Because I have for a long time been curious about how people make peace with the end, how they deal with that. From being my own father's side as he was dying from cancer, I know just how challenging it can be for people to face their own mortality. because my father was like, can you believe I'm not going to make it to 90? But I do know that Dr. Griffiths was filled with wonder and contentment, and I wanted to share something he said during our conversation about how he came to terms with his diagnosis. I went through a series of psychological conditions, he said. I probed into anxiety and depression and denial and resentment, and what I turned to was a gratitude practice. And the volume was turned up on the preciousness of what it is to be alive. So even in his final hours, he found a way to be grateful. I'm sharing a link to the class here in case you want to rewatch that or miss it last time. I also donated to the Ronald R. Griffiths PhD Professorship Fund, a research endowment that is going to continue to do the good work that he started. And what I know is that so much of what he had to say and teach us, we will be learning and opening ourselves to in the future in ways that we weren't able to see in the past. So I say, go well, Dr. Ronald Griffiths. Go well to all of you this week as well. So this article is in Wellness, What to Do When Your Doctor Won't Listen. Women's medical concerns are routinely dismissed, and it's even worse for women of color. Here's how to advocate for yourself before it's too late. When Francia Benson, a 38-year-old Latina woman from Utah, began suffering from body aches, depression, and anxiety 12 years ago, a friend suggested she get tested for Lyme disease. When the results came back negative, Benson's doctor insinuated that her symptoms were all in her head. I was treated like I was crazy. I went through dark moments of depression not only because I didn't get help, but because of how my symptoms were dismissed, she says. 7 years later, still seeking answers for inexplicable headaches, rashes, exhaustion, and joint pain that often brought her to tears, she finally found a doctor who was willing to revisit her records. He confirmed what Benson had always suspected. Her first doctor had misread the results. Her original Lyme test had been positive. By now, the Lyme was wreaking havoc on her nervous system, and she estimates she was in pain up to 90% of the time. Because so many years had passed since the initial test, Benson's new doctor didn't offer treatment or explain how the disease would continue to progress. Refusing to give up, she since sought opinions from two neurologists, neither of whom have given her a definitive diagnosis for her now much more complex case. Benson has spent countless hours and thousands of dollars seeking answers and feels robbed of her ability to live her life. She's still searching for a doctor who will listen to her. Each year, an estimated 795,000 people die or become disabled from misdiagnoses. And a study from the healthcare app Livi, that's L-I-V-I, shows that 57% of women suspect they have been wrongly diagnosed. As Denise Hayater Lindenmuth, and that's A-H-Y-A-T-E-R-L-I-N-D-E-N-M-U-T-H, Executive Director of the National Women's Health Network, a non-profit advocacy organization, bluntly puts it, misdiagnosis is more prevalent among women because healthcare providers tend to minimize or disregard the severity of women's symptoms. She emphasizes that this is even more pervasive for women of color, who often face implicit biases and systemic racism in addition to gender bias. Kavita K. Patel, MD, a professor of medicine at Stanford University, says that many factors can affect the quality and accuracy of your diagnosis, from the time of the day to what you wear to your doctor's gender. For instance, morning appointments are best, since doctors often suffer from decision fatigue later in the day, which can reduce your chances of being screened for life-threatening conditions. You might want to dress neatly and look pulled together, since a study published in Health Professors Education suggests doctors spend less time analyzing the cases of patients who look poor. And if you want a doctor who is more communicative and will spend additional time with you, your best bet is a female physician. Per a review in the Journal of the American Medical Association, on average, female doctors spend 2 minutes more with each patient than their male counterparts. These are all reasons you should get a second opinion. 21% of patients who do so walk away with a completely different diagnosis and learn to advocate for yourself in the exam room. The bottom line, Delays in diagnosis translate to delays in potentially life-saving care. Here's what to do and say to make your doctor really hear you. 1. Thoroughly vet any new doctor. Before making an appointment with someone new, ask for recommendations and read online reviews. Patel suggests using a virtual or telehealth service if you live in a health desert, an area with inadequate access to medical care. When you do call the office, ask these initial questions, and if the answers don't satisfy you, move on. These are my symptoms. Is this something the doctor specializes in? What routine screenings can I expect? If I have follow-up questions, what is the best way to get in touch with the doctor and how quickly will I get a response? 2, research your symptoms. We're not suggesting you go down a Google rabbit hole, but it's totally fine to research your symptoms before your appointment. Just make sure you stick to reputable websites like mayoclinic.org and stay away from Facebook groups. Those keyboard warriors may have good intentions, but they usually don't have medical degrees. Patel advises integrating your findings into the conversation instead of using them to challenge your physician. This shows that you want your care to be a collaborative effort. Try saying this: I did some research and saw some recommended/alternative treatments you haven't mentioned. I trust your judgment, and I'm wondering what you think of these options. 3, write down key questions before you go. It's hard to think on your feet when they're dangling from an examination table and you're literally looking up to your doctor. Writing down questions ensures that you don't forget to ask the important ones and sends a message that you plan to be proactive about your treatment. Ask for clarification and don't hold back. Hyder Lindenmuth says, your provider is there to give you the highest quality of care. Start with these and get more specific as needed. What do you think caused this condition? What tests or medications do you suggest, and are there side effects? What do I do if my symptoms get worse? What would you recommend if I were your mother? This one always makes them stop and think. 4, bring a wing person. Processing and retaining information while sitting in one of those cotton gowns and either sweating in an airless room or freezing from Arctic AC, it's near impossible. Having someone with you can listen, ask questions, and take notes is key. If you can't find someone to accompany you, have them listen in on speakerphone. Here's what to say when you're summoned for your appointment. I need a support person, so I hope you don't mind that my partner/friend/sibling is coming with me. 5, articulate your pain. In a 2019 Healthy Women survey, 36% of women felt their doctor hadn't taken their pain seriously. And a shocking 2016 University of Virginia study found that almost half of first and second year medical school students believed that black people experienced less pain than white people. This is why it's crucial to be clear about your pain level. Think about how your pain affects your daily life. Does it hurt to stand for long periods of time, climb stairs, or lift heavy objects? Is it worse at certain times of day, or do certain activities exacerbate symptoms? Does it wake you at night? Share a few tangible details, then focus on your top concerns during your appointment, since getting lost in a long list of ailments can cause the doctor to miss the one that's most important to you, says Patel. If you don't feel like you've landed on a solid plan, say something like, I'm doing everything I can to deal with the pain. Here is what I've tried. What more can I do? And at what level of pain do you suggest I come back to seek additional care, and what would that look like? 6, claim your time. The corporatization of healthcare and reduced compensation from insurance companies are two main reasons doctors' visits have gotten shorter, now averaging 15 minutes, down from 20.8 minutes in 2010. One study found that patients of color and patients with public health insurance, such as Medicaid, have even less face time with the physician. Since her long-delayed Lyme disease, Francia Benson has called out doctors when they won't let her get a word in edgewise because they're trying to wrap things up and move on to their next patient. She speaks firmly and makes sure to come across as knowledgeable and requests the tests she feels she needs. When your doc is racing to the finish, look them in the eye and say slowly and clearly, I know you're busy, but I need a few questions answered before I leave. I don't feel confident that we've solved this issue. Are there additional tests you might consider running? Can you repeat what you just told me so I can be 100% sure we are on the same page? Number 7. Take a final stand. You can do the right research, bring a friend, ask all the smart questions, and still walk out feeling like your doctor hasn't heard you, in which case it's time to address the issue directly. If you don't feel comfortable doing that in the moment, see if your provider has a patient advocate with whom you can lodge a complaint and express your concerns, says Hayter Lindenmuth. It's important to set expectations and remember that your doctor has an obligation to educate you so you can make the best informed decisions, Patel adds. You deserve a doctor who will respect and listen to you. They are out there. You just have to find them. Here's a firm but friendly script. I appreciate and respect your time and expertise, but I feel like you aren't listening to me as your patient. I would like to continue with your practice, but in order to do so, we need to work together. Can you please provide me with a clear plan for my care or perhaps recommend someone who can? This is another article in Wellness. This therapy is like a personal trainer for your mind and your soul. When we feel rudderless, we crave answers. But in the growing field of philosophical counseling, the real power is in asking questions. 10 months into quarantine, the passage of time began to confuse me. Life becomes smaller, and the gray wash routine of it made the hours creep by. At the same time, I felt my real life was flashing by somewhere out there, a trail of missed opportunities in its wake. In December, my elderly in-laws died of COVID. 1, 2, a painful reminder of death's inevitability. Sitting silently on my sofa between slugs of warming wine, I pondered in earnest. Was I using my time here well? I had experienced depression before and been gratefully righted by therapy and medication. This was different. This stew felt more existential. I decided to consult a philosophical counselor. I'd come across the concept during some 2 a.m. doom scrolling. A newish breed of helpers. Philosophical counselors may have a master's or a PhD in philosophy, but have stepped out of the lecture hall to use their insights in helping clients work through thorny life issues, such as midlife crisis, relationship dilemmas, career crossroads. Some are certified through the American Philosophical Practitioners Association, APPA, or the National Philosophical Counseling Association, NPCA. But because there is no legal regulation of the field, anyone with a philosophy background could call herself a philosophical counselor. Unlike psychotherapists, they don't diagnose or treat mental health conditions, like clinical depression or panic disorder, or prescribe medication, and most don't take insurance. Instead, they lead you through sessions to whip your thinking into shape, like personal trainers for the mind and soul. Having first appeared in the U.S. in the 1990s, philosophical counselors use a variety of approaches. Most engage you in deep conversation, pulling from their training to help you question the logic and assumptions made behind your thinking. Some practitioners might suggest you read a little Jean-Paul Sartre or Lao Tzu, or quote tidbits from philosophy's great minds who, over the millennia, have worried about the same problems troubling you today. If you're struggling with feeling disconnected from a friend, for example, they may share Aristotle's views on friendship so you can see your own situation in a different light. Philosophy has a rep as navel-gazing. It's seen as a series of rarefied brain teasers about the sound of one hand clapping or the number of angels that fit on the end of a pin. But Sky Cleary, Ph.D., a lecturer of philosophy at Barnard College, and co-editor of How to Live a Good Life, A Guide to Choosing Your Personal Philosophy, begs to differ. For thousands of years, philosophy, which means love of wisdom, wasn't confined to the ivory tower, she says. It was happening on the streets. Socrates and company led pupils through dialogues to coax greater self-understanding, asking, why are we here? How should we live? Was not just an intellectual exercise. Epicurus believed philosophy was essentially medicine for the soul, a practice with useful applications for solving the problems of everyday life. Today, philosophical counseling is still a niche field, but it's growing steadily, according to Lou Marinoff, Ph.D., a professor of philosophy at the City College of New York and president of APPA. To find one, you can scroll through the practitioner directories at appa.edu and npcassoc.org. Not surprisingly, demand for philosophical counselors and for APPA training programs has increased during the pandemic, he reports. According to Cleary, that's because we tend to go through life on autopilot, busy with work, family, our phones, and we don't stop and reflect on the big picture until we run into a crisis. But while crises can be scary, there are also opportunities for growth. As adults, we get out of the habit of asking questions, says Cleary, but if we stop doing so, we become passive. Things happen to us rather than us seizing our own destiny. Seeking help with my own questions, I met my modern-day Socrates via Zoom. Monica Vilhauer, V-I-L-H-A-U-E-R, Ph.D., is the founder of Curious Soul Philosophy in Portland, Oregon. Half a continent apart, we bonded over the fear our dogs would interrupt. She had bribed hers with a mini jar of peanut butter. Vilhauer asked me background questions much like a therapist would. What was I concerned about? I told her about my quarantine-induced ennui, how I felt stuck in Groundhog Day, fretting I wasn't making use of my time well. Shakespeare wrote King Lear during the plague, right? Like the rest of the planet, I was missing spending time with friends and faraway family and generally felt unmoored. She listened attentively, then guided me to question my thinking. Has all the solitude perhaps been a time of opportunity, too? While spending lots of time alone, are there ways to feel connected to something outside yourself? I reflected that long walks by the river had been a pleasure, renewing my appreciation of nature. Come to think of it, I had picked up journaling. Vilhauer shared a few of her experiences, too, giving our session the feel of a conversation. I love Thoreau's ideas about the freedoms of solitude, she offered. To paraphrase, he said, when you travel by yourself, you can start any time. Thoreau seemed like good company to me, because I could view my house as my Walden. As I hung up, I felt like a window had been thrown open in my brain and fresh air had entered. Afterward, I kept mulling over the unlikely positives of this difficult year. I'd tried to see the bright side before, but somehow knowing that great thinkers endorse silver linings made it stick. Unpacking my concerns about my mortality would take additional sessions and more peanut butter. But all clients seek out philosophical counselors, Hamlet-style, to ponder life's big to-be-or-not-to-be questions. Many come for one session to discuss a specific personal problem, such as a decision to move or an ethical conflict. A client may say her parents expect her to be a lawyer, but she wants to be an artist, says Sean Holland, Ph.D., a philosophical counselor and consultant in New York City. The expectations of family sit in tension with what she feels, causing her distress. I might ask her to consider, on what grounds do you believe making a lot of money is the measure of success? Philosophical counseling is about reaching down and challenging your deepest assumptions. With or without philosophical counseling, learning to step back and ask questions can be a powerful tool in difficult times. Diana Wu, David author of Future Proof, Reinventing Work in the Age of Acceleration, did just that when she learned that her mother, who had been suffering from breast cancer for 3 years, was about to die. Rather than labeling the experience as devastating, and it was, I committed to being curious about it, she says. I thought about the concept of a good death, what role I could play in helping my mother have one, and if I could learn anything that would eventually help me make that passage too. To the end, David and her mother read Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, together. In one of her final days, I brought oranges from the tree in her yard to the hospital for her nurses. Surprisingly, my mother was able to eat one too, recalls David. The smell, the taste, the feel of it, I remember it so vividly. It made me realize how important these small moments are. They are life. The experience didn't just change how David perceived her mother's death, but how she approaches her own day-to-day existence. When difficult things happen, we can try to hide them in a dark corner of our minds, or we can look closely and see what we can learn, she says. I now bring this attitude to everything. When someone is doing something that bothers me, I step back to say to myself, "That's interesting." That pause, combined with curiosity, expands the possibilities of how I can react. Ultimately, philosophy helps you ask the right questions, but it doesn't supply easy answers. There's no secret answer key, says Vilhauer. Still, the act of questioning helps you consider new perspectives. Cleary told me Simone de Beauvoir believed we are never fully formed, but a series of evolving selves. That may be a philosophical truth, but it's also a practical reminder that we're all works in progress and that life is a series of new possibilities. In culture and news, Rachel Ray and Anthony Carino return to TV with Rachel Ray's Rebuild. It's a cause close to Rachel's heart. After 17 seasons, Rachel Ray's beloved daytime talk show ended on May 24th. However, this won't be the last you see of Rachel Ray on TV, as she already has a new show premiering on Hulu October 23rd. The show, Rachel Ray's Rebuild, focuses on helping families rebuild their homes after uncontrollable circumstances like fires and natural disasters turn their lives upside down. The 10-episode season shares the journey of 10 different families trying to rebuild after disaster with the help of Rachel and construction professional Anthony Carino from HGTV's Kitchen Cousins. How did Rachel Ray get involved in a home reno show? As many fans may remember, in 2020, Rachel Ray's New York home burned down. During this difficult time, Ray shared her struggle and journey with fans on her talk show and beyond. As Ray and her husband, John Cusimano, rebuilt their home and mourned the loss of some of their most prized possessions, fans lent their support and shared stories of similar experiences. This experience opened Ray's eyes to the sheer volume of people who could use a helping hand after facing tragedies similar to her own. Rachel had a house fire of her own back in 2020 in the middle of the pandemic. So, as she was sharing that with her audience and figuring out that it's actually something that people need help with, and this is going to be a TV show, she asked me if I'd be willing to do it, and I said, absolutely. Rachel Ray's Rebuild co-host Anthony Carino told Country Living. Anthony, who has over 25 years of experience working in construction, was happy to help his longtime friend make this dream a reality. Producers from the show select families in need whose homes were destroyed by fire, tornadoes, and other tragedies, primarily along the East Coast. A typical client puts themselves in the situation of being in a renovation that is stressful and has to have a lot of decisions made and upsets their life. These folks have not made that decision. It's been forced on them, Carino said. How does Rachel Ray and her crew help? At the beginning of each episode, Ray and Carino sit down with the homeowners to get a glimpse of the current state of their home and their plans for the rebuild. Generally, the families have already made strides in the rebuild process before Rachel's crew gets involved. Rather than slow the process down and start over, we would work with the team that had already been hired, Carino explained. With Carino's extensive experience in construction, he is then able to step in and take much of the emotional and physical load off of the families. He handles everything from managing construction proceedings to duking it out with insurance companies to ensure the rebuild goes as smoothly as possible. Whenever they can, Carino, Ray, and producers contribute to stretch the clients' budgets. With vast connections in construction, Carino reaches out to brands for free or discounted materials. The network pulls from their budget to chip in when necessary, and Ray even pulls from her own pocket and leans on her connections in some cases to add pieces she knows the families will cherish. From total destruction to the final walkthrough, each rebuild takes an average of 3 to 4 months. Of course, at the end of every successful project, there's a big celebration as the family finally sees their finished home for the first time. And the icing on the cake is that at the end of each episode, Ray makes the family one of her signature home-cooked meals right inside their new kitchen. Through all the television that I've done, bringing people back into their homes never gets old. You never take it for granted. That look on their faces is fantastic. And then you do it with somebody like Rach, where we can add that super special meal to it. On top of that, Rachel really touches a lot of lives. She's been on television a long time. People really relate to her, and she is so great with people. She fully embraces the hugs and takes pictures with everybody, and people are so thrilled to see her in their home. Overall, it's just a really special moment to be a part of, Carino described. We're staying in culture and news for now, and this next article is Martha Stewart, 82, claps back at people who say she doesn't dress her age. The star isn't holding back. Martha Stewart always looks her best, but recently the lifestyle mogul has had a particularly fabulous few weeks of dressing, and naturally, naysayers chimed in. If you didn't see, the 82-year-old wore a sparkly high-slit gown, a little black dress, and a bedazzled pantsuit to various events in New York City, all documented on Instagram. And in a new interview, Stewart clapped back at the idea that she doesn't dress her age with the most clever response. She presented her case for ageless fashion at the Fashion Group International Night of Stars Gala, where Page Six specifically asked her about dressing for one's age. Stewart laughed. "Dressing for whose age?" she said. "What a great point." "I've dressed the same since I was 17," she continued. "If you look at my pictures on Instagram, I look pretty much the same." Stewart added that she thinks everyone deserves to look and feel fabulous regardless of the number of years they've lived. "I don't think about age. I think people are more and more and more fabulous than they've ever been in their senior years, and I applaud every one of them," she said. That sentiment was made clear when she covered Sports Illustrated swimsuit at 81 in May. She knew the statement it made, and she stood by it. In fact, she loved that her cover gave other women her age permission to be bold. "That's what's happening. People are now reimagining their future, and that's what it's all about," she told Variety at the time. Stewart wants people to follow in her footsteps and take age out of the equation in terms of self-expression and opportunity. "Age is not the determining factor in terms of friendship or in terms of success," she told Sports Illustrated. "But what people do, how people think, and how people act, that's what's important, and not your age." So why should it matter what Stewart chooses to wear? Thankfully, for as much criticism as she received in her Instagram comments, there was twice as much, if not more, support from fellow pro-aging cheerleaders, and we are certainly among them. Another article in Culture and News, Reese Witherspoon does this very relatable thing when she feels lonely. Witherspoon revealed she broke down a year ago because she didn't feel like I was taking very good care of myself. Reese Witherspoon let fans get up close with the inner workings of her personal life. At this past weekend's Hello Sunshine, Shine Away event, Witherspoon participated in a vulnerable onstage chat with fellow actor Tracy Ellis Ross and described how she has typically coped with feelings of loneliness and uncertainty, sometimes to her own detriment. "I've always been trying really hard to find balance outside of work," she told Ross, according to People. "I'm a person who fills my schedule with busyness, so that I feel less alone or less nervous or less unsettled. Work has always been my balm, and I started to realize that isn't going to work for me." Witherspoon announced her divorce from talent agent Jim Toth, whom she was married to for nearly 12 years back in March. At some point in the months that followed, the morning show star said she broke. "About a year ago, I was a robot, and the robot broke," she said emotionally. "I cried and cried. I think I texted you," she told Ross, who replied, "I remember." "I did. I texted Tracy. I was like, the robot broke, and it actually makes me feel very vulnerable sharing that with y'all," Witherspoon continued. "But I think it's important we hold up so much for so many." Witherspoon then recited a poem by her friend, writer Cleo Wade, about being the glue that holds it all together. The actor and producer explained her interpretation of the poem. "Sometimes you are the glue in everybody's life, whether it's at work or being a mom or being a partner, but who is holding you together? It's really important to remember that you have to be the glue that holds yourself together." She added that she had an emotional reaction upon reading the poem for the first time. "I burst into tears because I didn't feel like I was taking very good care of myself, and I wasn't asking other people for help." This next article is from the Work and Money section. How to recover financially after your divorce. Step 1, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and whip out your bank statements. Each year, almost 700,000 Americans get divorced. An even more sobering fact is that post-divorce women's average household income fall by 41%, while men's decrease by just 22%. But as tough as things may seem right now, this could well be a time for investing in yourself. If you've traditionally had a tricky relationship with money, now is the time to heal, learn, and thrive. And if you're already great with your finances, this is your chance to be totally in charge. One of the most liberating things you can do is start taking ownership over your money, says Tori Dunlap, author of the instant New York Times bestseller Financial Feminists. Maybe you've seen money as a barrier or as something your ex managed, but you can make the shift to seeing it as freeing and exciting. You now have complete control over your earning and spending decisions and can use that money as a tool to take care of yourself and your family. Once the dust has settled, follow these steps from Dunlap to get back on your track with your finances. Get the lay of the land. Before you can find your feet, you need to know exactly what's going on with your money. That means pulling your head out of the sand and taking a hard look at the good, the bad, and the ugly. It's common in relationships for couples to settle into different roles, and if your ex handled the finances, you'll have your work cut out for you while you relearn this skill. But even if you knew your household money inside out, you'll be facing a whole new financial landscape post-divorce. You'll be dropping from 2 household incomes to 1. Maybe you'll now be paying half your kids' tuition. Maybe the mortgage and home insurance payments are now entirely on you. Whatever your specific circumstances, there's a lot to get a handle on. So set aside a good chunk of time to figure out a detailed financial picture. This could be a spreadsheet or a giant piece of paper. The important thing is to be thorough. Jot down absolutely all of your mortgage or rent payments, bills, day-to-day spending, loan or credit card repayments, retirement plans, bank balances, and school tuitions if you have them. Ask yourself all the key questions. How much do I have in my bank accounts and where does this money live? Says Dunlap. How much credit card debt do I have and what is the interest rate? What are the terms of any loans I have? Once you have a clear financial picture, you can start to make some decisions. If you consider yourself clueless, it's time to get savvy. Read Dunlap's book. Watch How to Get Rich on Netflix. Listen to personal finance podcasts like the Women's Investor Community podcast from the whip-smart Diana Ritchie, who turned her own divorce into the chance to invest savvily and is now teaching other women to do the same. The Money with Katie Show, who somehow makes the driest financial topics seem compelling, and Dunlap's Financial Feminists, which come with the alluring promise of helping you gain financial freedom and kick some patriarchal behind at the same time. Although it may be tempting to call in the backup, Dunlap says this shouldn't be your first port of call. A lot of women who were married to a man who was handling their bigger financial decisions immediately think, "Well, I need a financial advisor," she says. The truth is, 99% of people don't need one. You don't need a financial bro named Chad. You can figure this out for yourself. Unfortunately, I see a lot of women go someplace like Edward Jones and pay 3-5% in fees. Make an emergency fund. If you got money from the divorce, your first financial win is putting aside 3-6 months of living expenses in a high-yield savings account, says Dunlap. You've just been through such a tumultuous time. You want your head to hit the pillow at night knowing that your money can take care of you should something happen. If you didn't receive a payment in your settlement, building this emergency buffer should be your top priority, Dunlap says. We don't want to go into more debt trying to pay for an emergency. Make the payments for any debt, but don't pay anything extra until this emergency fund is sorted. Next, focus on eradicating your higher interest debt, anything over 7%, i.e. most credit cards. Then you can move on to saving for retirement and finally paying off your lower interest debt. Get on top of your credit score. Credit score in good shape? Great. Skip this section. If you have no idea what yours is, use a free service like Credit Karma or Credit Sesame to find out. Ideally, your number is higher than 670. Unfortunately, I often see women who have been the co-signer on their parents' credit card, on their partner's credit card, says Dunlap. They've been able to make purchases, but they are not actually building their own credit. Some factors that influence your credit score, such as the length of your credit history, are beyond your current control, but there are a couple of ways to build your number quickly and strategically. Unsurprisingly, the most important thing you can do is to pay your bills quickly and on time with zero balance on your credit cards. Next, look to increase how much credit you have access to. A smart way to improve your score is to increase the amount of credit you have available without actually using it. Credit utilization is exactly what it sounds, how much credit you're using, explains Dunlap. If you have a $10,000 credit limit and you spend $3,000, you have a 30% credit utilization rate. You should aim to utilize the least amount of available credit possible, under 30% or even under 10% if you can swing that. Here's the simple move. Call your credit provider and ask for an increase, then just don't spend any more money. This is one of the easiest ways to build up your credit because you're proving that you're a responsible credit card user. You're saying, you give me a huge credit line increase, but I didn't use it, even though I could, says Dunlap. Visualize your future. This is the fun part. It's not about the math, says Dunlap. It's about planning how to use money as a tool to build the life you want. Maybe you're picturing yourself with your mortgage paid off, or maybe you want to buy an RV and travel. For me personally, I'm picturing Nana Tori drinking wine with lunch and transversing through Italy. She's having a great time, but I can't give her that unless I do a little bit of work on my end. Once you have that dream vision, work backward. You should be thinking, how do I use money as a tool to get there? What sort of savings goals do I need to make in order to do that? What sort of payoff plan do I need to make for my mortgage? Make a plan. Schedule a monthly money date to track your progress and make it a good one. Open that bottle of wine. Order your favorite takeout. Do whatever you need to do to make this routine feel good, says Dunlap. I want every woman to see money as a tool to start building a life that they love, not the reason they can't. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Here are some banned books that you might be interested in. The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. Considered one of the most influential books of the past 20 years, legal scholar Michelle Alexander's staggering interrogation of the ways in which modern America's criminal justice system, as a result of decades of disastrous and inexplicitly racist policies like the supposed war on drugs, disproportionately affects people of color, is a necessary re-examination of our nation's recent past and a reminder of what we must undo to change its present. And that was by Abram X. Kendi, K-E-N-D-I, wrote that. Number two, Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda by Becky Albertalli. And that last name is spelled A-L-B-E-R-T-A-L-L-I. Read the book that inspired the adorable 2018 movie Love, Simon. 16-year-old Simon Spier, S-P-I-E-R, is gay, but not ready to come out. He's most honest and at ease when exchanging flirty emails under a pseudonym to a friend online. When someone gets the emails and threatens to spill his secret, Simon's budding relationship is put in jeopardy. And that blurb was written by Elena Nicolaou, N-I-C-A-L-A-O-U. Number three, The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin. James Baldwin wrote The Fire Next Time to galvanize readers of all backgrounds to end the racial nightmare and in doing so, achieve our country and change the history of the world. First published in 1963, The Fire Next Time is often credited with giving a voice to the civil rights movement, but Baldwin's essays about his childhood in Harlem and the urgent need for racial justice are as relevant as ever. That was written by Claudia Rankin. Number four, Cool for the Summer by Dahlia Adler, D-A-H-L-I-A, and the last name is A-D-L-E-R. Yes, echoes of Demi Lovato's 2015 bop resound throughout these sweet and sultry pages, But Adler's novel offers a wonderfully queer spin on another August Becomes September anthem, Greece's Summer Nights. Larissa had spent her summer vacation in the Outer Banks of North Carolina, where she met and fell for the enrapturing Jasmine. Returning to school in New York and to her hopelessly devoted crush on a hot football hunk, Chase, she's more than a little surprised to find Jasmine there lighting up the hallways. When Chase finally asks her out, Larissa's dreams of dating the perfect boy are ripped at the seams. That was written by Michelle Hart. Number 5. The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. Now a critically acclaimed television series on Hulu, Atwood's dystopian novel follows a handmaid named Ofred, who's subjected to life under the laws of a near-future North America called Gilead. The society follows the Bible's book of Genesis verbatim, subjecting women to cruelty in the name of replenishing the diminished population. That was written by Mackenzie Jean-Philippe. Number 6, Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. Kathy, Ruth, and Tommy spent their adolescence at a secluded English boarding school, kept away from the outside world. Only after Ruth and Tommy escape do they discover why they've been isolated. Ishiguro's speculative tour de force is a poignant coming-of-age tale about sacrifice, impermanence, and what it means to be human. That's by Carolyn Quimby. Number 7, The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas. To call The Hate U Give a bestseller would be an understatement. Angie Thomas's debut novel about a black teenage girl torn between her neighborhood and fitting in at her private high school is a mega hit that raised a national dialogue on urgent topics like racism and police violence. 16-year-old star Carter's worlds collide after she witnesses the fatal shooting of her best friend Khalil. That was written by E.N. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.